2, 1.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to lecture number 6. I see there's 7 people here so far. That sounds like it should fit for lecture 6. Now, before I get into the lecture, I just noticed I was going through the quizzes again. There was one question that several people missed. It was, I asked something about David Ricardo, not the character who played Lucy's husband on the television show, but the economist. And a lot of people didn't get that Ricardo was concerned with the distribution of wealth. I think this is a bit tricky. I didn't intend it to be tricky, but a lot of people, when they think of economists, they'll think, oh, well, the economist has to be concerned with how wealth grows, and that was certainly true of Ricardo's predecessor, Adam Smith, but it wasn't true of Ricardo. He was concerned, he took the amount of wealth in a society is fixed, and he was concerned with how it's distributed among the landlords, capitalists, and workers. So he's interested in distribution, not in production. So that's one thing to bear in mind. Now, what I'm going to be talking about today is Murray Rothbard's politics. One thing about, we've studied Rothbard as a historian, as a political philosopher and legal philosopher, as a writer in history of economics. So he was very much an academic, someone he taught in universities. He was concerned with advancing the bounds of knowledge. But he was someone, as you know, who had a very definite view of how society should be organized. He was a libertarian anarchist. He believed in anarcho-capitalism. And so he wasn't just concerned to study politics or people in society just as a mere academic matter, say the way a lepidopterist studies butterflies. He actually wanted to do something, to put into effect the ideas he considered the right ones. So he's different from most intellectuals in that way. Probably most intellectuals have opinions on political issues of one sort or other, but they don't usually devote a lot of their time to actually organizing any political movements or engaging in politics. Political action, but Rothbard certainly did. And I think it's very interesting in this connection to compare Rothbard with a figure who had very different views to Rothbard, namely Karl Marx. And probably many of you will have come across the famous 11th Feuerbach thesis of Marx. Marx wrote in He studied the German left-wing Hegelian Ludwig Feuerbach, you know, the one who famously said, man is what he eats. So he wrote on him. He thought that Feuerbach had the right view, and he thought that Feuerbach thought belief in God is merely a projection of human attributes onto the outside world. So Marx thought that was right, but he thought Feuerbach had neglected politics. So in this famous 11th Feuerbach thesis, he said, Marx said, philosophers have hitherto only interpreted the world. The point, however, is to change it. And I think Rothbard would say, well, we have to both interpret and change the world. So he wouldn't say we shouldn't concentrate on interpreting the world. We should just concentrate on changing it. But he's concerned with both. And perhaps Marx wasn't so far apart from Rothbard there in wanting to both interpret and change the world, despite what he said in the Feuerbach thesis, and also despite the very big differences in both interpreting the world and the way they wanted to change the world between Rothbard and Marx. They were, in many respects, diametrically opposed, but I think in this respect, they were similar. They both were interested in changing the world. Now, if you ask people, say just anyone in the street who've heard of Rothbard, who was Murray Rothbard, or who is he? Most people, I think, would say a libertarian economist, and I think they'd be right on that. So you would think if Rothbard is a libertarian economist, then the main issues he'd be interested in would be strictly ones about economics, like the monetary system, minimum wage laws, all sorts of the business cycle. And he was very, very interested in that. But all those economic issues were not the single most important issue for Rothbard. The single most important issue for him was peace. So for him, the primary issue throughout his long political career, which ranged from the late 1940s to his death in January 1995, he has a very long political career, and he's always interested in which group is going to promote peace the most, and that determines his alliances. So this is why I think it's the most important issue, because that's the one that accounts for his political alliances. Just let me give you one illustration of that. In 1964, most people who favored the free market were very much in favor of Barry Goldwater. I remember I was in high school at the time. I was very strongly in favor of Goldwater, because he seemed like he was a very strong free market person. But Rothbard wasn't, because Goldwater had a very violent foreign policy. For example, he was willing to risk nuclear war to get rid of Castro in Cuba, get rid of the communist regime. So for Rothbard was very much against Goldwater, even though he was much more free market oriented, aside from foreign policy, than his opponent, Lyndon Johnson. So for Rothbard, the big issue is which groups are supporting peace. And just another illustration that might surprise people, when Eisenhower ran against Adlai Stevenson in 1952, Rothbard supported Stevenson because he was the more he wasn't a pacifist, but he had a more peaceful policy than the one Rothbard thought Eisenhower had. 1956, he supported T. Coleman Andrews, who was a third party candidate. But you see, for Rothbard, the big issue was war or peace, and he would keep shifting his political alliances depending on which groups would be against war. Now, from the end of World War II, and when Rothbard was a student at Columbia during World War II, and then after he continued as a grad student, so he's very active in politics beginning then. So from the period of the end of World War II to the early 60s, Rothbard was associated with the American right. And at this time, libertarianism was considered a part of the conservative movement. You know, nowadays we have left libertarians, and then there are people who say, well, libertarianism really doesn't, you can't place libertarianism on the left-right spectrum. It's really independent. But in those days, which I remember very well, at least in the early 60s, people who were libertarians would generally consider themselves part of the conservative movement. We would think we were opposed to the left, and the William Volcker Fund that I mentioned in previous lectures would support both libertarian and conservative scholars. So if you were a libertarian in those days, the scholars you'd be seeing besides other libertarians would be mostly political conservatives. And the group, the part of the old right, the conservatives, the American right, that Rothbard was especially interested was one he called the old right. Now, as far as I know, it was Rothbard who called it that. That was his name for it. And the group he was interested had opposed America's entry into World War I and World War II. So, again, what he's interested in this right wing, why is he allied with this group he calls the old right? Because he's interested in peace and not war. So this is the group who was opposed to America's entry into World War I and II. And yes, I see Craig mentions John T. Flynn. I'll be getting to him. I think he's on the next slide. I wouldn't forget Flynn. That's John T. Flynn, not Errol Flynn. Maybe you should remember him, too. So this group, the old right, included libertarians such as Albert J. Knock, who was you may remember him for the book Our Enemy, The State, which is one that gives the view that Rothbard supported, that views the state as a predatory body that's not engaged in productive work, but they're just taking things from the productive elements of society. It's an instrument of predation. Knock was a follower of the German sociologist Franz Oppenheimer, who later became an exile in the United States. And besides Knock, among these figures was these libertarians who were part of the old right in the way Rothbard conceptualized this, with H.L. Mencken, the great individualist, the one who had the great stylist. He was a very humorous writer. He once said about Woodrow Wilson, for example, that Wilson should apply for the first vacancy in the Trinity. And Garrett was another one. He was a very well-known journalist and writer. He had a very fine style. He was also one of these individualists who were in the old right. But the old right, these figures, Knock, Mencken, and Garrett, could all be considered libertarians. But somebody says here, Neil says God had 10 points. Wilson has 14. I mean, I think that was Clemenceau who said that the 10 commandments were enough for God. It was in response to Woodrow Wilson's 14 points. Yes. So, besides these individualists, there were also people who, libertarians, there were people who weren't libertarians, but that Rothbard classed as among the old right. And one was a progressive Senator Burton K. Wheeler, who commented on Franklin Roosevelt's foreign policy once. He said he was referring to the he drew analogy with Roosevelt's AAA, the Agricultural Adjustment Administration, which had a program of paying farmers to plow under part of their crops in an effort to raise prices. So Wheeler said Roosevelt has a AAA foreign policy. He wants to plow under every fourth American boy, to which Roosevelt responded this was the rottenest thing that had been said in public life in his generation. And another one in this group was Colonel Robert McCormick, who was a publisher of the Chicago Tribune, which is a newspaper Rothbard subscribed to, even though he lived in New York. It had a lot of the great isolationist writers like George Morgenstern, who wrote the book on Pearl Harbor, and Chesley Manley, Walter Trohan. McCormick himself was a very aristocratic figure, very much a personal. He knew Roosevelt socially, and they didn't, for them from the same upper class group, and they just didn't get along with each other. Now, the isolationists, the people wanted to thought that America shouldn't favor a peaceful foreign policy, thought that America shouldn't intervene in European power politics following the advice of George Washington in his famous farewell address. They thought that America had made a mistake by entering World War One. At a time World War One was going on, there was a propaganda campaign to say there was a German conspiracy led by Kaiser Wilhelm II, and the Germans wanted to take over the world, that they had started the war in a kind of a bid for world power. But after the war, this view was criticized by revisionist historians. They were called revisionists because they wanted to revise Article 231 of the Versailles Treaty, which was the treaty of peace between the Allied powers and Germany after World War One. And Article 231 said that Germany was exclusively responsible for the war. So Sidney Fay, who was a professor of history at Harvard, wrote three articles in the American Historical Review 1920 and 1921 where he challenged this verdict. He said, no, it wasn't the case that the Germans had plotted to take over the world. Some of the documents that were supposed to show this were incorrectly interpreted or were based on misunderstandings. And he particularly attacked the American a book by the American ambassador to Turkey, Henry Morgenthau Sr., who had claimed there was some sort of crown council early in July 1914, that where the Kaiser and other members of the German cabinet had met and had plotted on a war. Fay said no, that was complete. Morgenthau had misinterpreted that. Incidentally, have any of you read the book by Barbara Tuchman on World War One, Guns of August? Do any of you know that book? Okay, Guns of August. I see Tuchman was the granddaughter of this man, Henry Morgenthau Sr. And Sidney Fay, who had lived long enough to see Tuchman's book come out, said that was the third generation of the Morgenthau family that had distorted history. So he wasn't very enthusiastic about it because this revisionist movement, as I'll mention, became very popular for a while, but then there was this movement against it. Now another one, probably the most famous publicist, the one who brought this historical view to popular attention, was Harry Elmer Barnes, who wrote a book called Genesis of the World War, which came out in 1926, I think second edition, 1928. And Fay, meanwhile, in 1928, wrote a long book, which was for many years considered the standard scholarly book on World War One origins, called The Origins of the World War in Two Volumes. If you get that, you should look at the 1930 edition is probably the one to get rather than the original 1928 edition, if you modified certain things. So Barnes is a more extreme revisionist than Fay. Fay said there was a divided responsibility for the war, but Barnes and Rothbard followed Barnes here, and he knew Barnes personally. Barnes said it was mainly France and Russia who were responsible for the war, that France was trying to get Alsace-Lorraine back. Remember, those two provinces had been surrendered to Germany after the Franco-Prussian War, 1870 to 1871, and Russia was interested in taking over Constantinople. So Barnes thought there had been an understanding between French President Raymond Poincaré and the Russian ambassador to France, Alexander Volsky, who was very influential. He'd been foreign minister of Russia before, to start a war. So that was the view that Rothbard accepted from Barnes. I used to know Barnes a little bit. I called him up when I was in high school. And I remember I asked him who he was supporting the 64 election, go on Goldwater against Lyndon Johnson. And he said to me, as my old friend Henry Mencken once said, I think I'll sit this one out. So, as Fay and Barnes were among the leading revisionists on the origins of the war in 1914. Now, on America's entry into the war in 1917, the definitive book was by Charles Tansel, who was one of the great American diplomatic historians, and he said that getting into the war really had not been in America's interest. We were drawn into the war principally through Wilson's unneutral policies that Woodrow Wilson had been very strict with Germany on America's rights and neutral power, but was inclined to let the British get away with violations of international law, such as the hunger blockade they imposed on Germany. And of course, as a result of Wilson's policy, the Secretary of State, William Jennings Bryan, resigned because he just said he couldn't take Wilson's unneutral policies anymore. So the revisionist view became very influential in the 1920s and 30s. So most people by the 30s thought America had made a mistake getting into World War I. But remember, in January 1933, there began a challenge to this isolationist view. That remember, January 30th, Hitler came to power, and he seemed to be very aggressive, that he was seemed bent on expanding Germany. So there was a shift among some people, but not most, probably the majority of the population, wanted to still stay out of intervening in European affairs. But there were some people, a lot of people said, oh, well, look, maybe the revisionists were right about World War I, but look, now we've got to stop Hitler. But the isolations of the 1930s included the person Craig mentioned earlier, John T. Flynn, who had been a liberal journalist writing on corporate corruption for the New Republic. And he, John and Garrett, they were not blind to the danger of Hitler, but they thought that the way to meet this danger, possible danger from Hitler, was not by giving American money foreign aid or even troops to Britain and her allies. Remember, World War II started in September 3rd, 1939, when Britain and France declared war on Germany after the German invasion of Poland September 1st, 1939. So what the isolationists said, well, what America should concentrate on is home defense rather than aiding Britain and her allies. If we could concentrate on home defense, we'd be prepared for any emergency, but we could stay out of the war. And they opposed FDR's pro-British policy, such as, I had a view called destroyers for bases, where in return for Britain allowing America to use certain British bases in America sent them destroyers that they could, ships that they could use in their naval battle, and also Lend-Lease, which was a program where America would supply Britain with various material without the British wouldn't have to pay for it right away. They could just lend them what they needed and hope they'd pay for it later. And so Rothbard aligned himself with this group and said, we ought to have stayed out of World War II. This group said, it was a mistake Roosevelt pursued too aggressive policy. He was trying to, Roosevelt, in this view, Tansel was the one who stressed this very much, but most of the revisionists like John T. Flynn also thought this, that Roosevelt had deliberately tried to provoke a Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor so that the U.S. could get into the European war, which he wanted. And Rothbard was definitely of this opinion, and he viewed World War II, not only America's entry, but he viewed the European war as avoidable. He agreed with A.J.P. Taylor in his 1961 book, Origins of the Second World War, that Hitler hadn't been planning a European war. Hitler was interested in revision of the Treaty of Versailles. He was interested in territorial changes to the advantage of Germany, but he wasn't, according to this view, aiming at any European conquest. It was just after the war started, then, and after he scored the big unexpected victory over France in 1940, then things changed somewhat. But according to Rothbard, he didn't take the view, as many people do, that Hitler was bent on world conquest. Rothbard was very consistent. He tended to doubt views that said, well, there's some enemy power that's aiming at conquering the world, so we've got to do something about it. And we'll see he took a similar view of the Russians in the Cold War. So he thought we could have kept out of World War II, and if Britain had adopted different policy in 1939, World War II could have been avoided. There's a book by Pat Buchanan that came out some years ago that took a similar point of view, that said Britain made a big mistake in the issuing a guarantee to Poland in March 1939. I think it's a very interesting thesis. So after World War II ended, remember, Russia and America were allied during the war to defeat the Germans. After the war, Russia and America started to have big differences of opinion. Remember Churchill's famous speech in Fulton, Missouri, at Westminster College in 1946. Remember his famous saying, from Stettin in the Adriatic to Trieste on the Baltic, an iron curtain has descended across the continent. Behind it lie all the ancient capitals of Europe. So Churchill, this is indicated, there's a big split between the Soviets and the U.S. They're not allies anymore. Now, this led to a big split on the American right. There were some conservatives. Now, Flynn, at this point, although he started off as a liberal journalist, could be considered a conservative by this time. Now, some people like Flynn and Herbert Hoover, remember Hoover was the former president, he was very much allied with the isolationists. These people opposed the Cold War. They continued to favor non-intervention. They said, well, just as we could avoid conflict with Germany in the 30s, we can also avoid conflict with Russia. Now we shouldn't get involved. We should stay out of things if we can. Another one who took this view was Joseph P. Kennedy, who had been American ambassador to England. He was the father of JFK. He was a very strong isolationist also, and he gave radio broadcasts criticizing the Cold War, which was beginning in the late 1940s. Now, there were other people who had been isolationists in the 30s who changed their mind. One reason for this was they had thought the isolationist argument was good against the Germans, but they were fervent anti-communists. and they thought, well, the communists really are aiming at world conquest. Germany wasn't, but the communists are, so we've got to really take a very active interventionist policy against them. Now, one historian, John Lukacs, who I've criticized in various of my nasty reviews, who say, look, the isolationists were really phonies, because what they really were was just pro-German people. So as soon as there was some power other than Germany that America was at odds with, namely Russia, then they were in favor of intervention. I don't think that claim holds up, because there were isolationists who were consistently against the World War II and also against the Cold War, so I don't think that claim really holds up. And Rothbard would certainly be an example of, he said, America had made a mistake in getting involved in World War I and World War II, but also America shouldn't go to war against Russia, even though Russia is a communist, leader of the communist world. Of course, Rothbard is extremely against communism as an economic system. We can see this split among American right in the Korean War, which lasted from 1950 to 53. Now, the old right forces, the ones who were against American involvement in foreign affairs, who thought America should concentrate more on home defense, they were led by Senator Robert Taft of Ohio. Now, Taft said the war was unconstitutional because it wasn't declared by Congress. Now, nowadays, we see the president just sends troops wherever he wants, but in those days, before the Korean War, that wouldn't have been accepted. Even Roosevelt, right after the Japanese attacked, you'd think, well, maybe wouldn't need a declaration of war just to respond to the Japanese attack. But he did. He went to Congress and asked for a declaration of war. And if you can go on YouTube, you can hear him his talk. It's one of Roosevelt, whatever his defects, was a great speaker. You can hear his talk where he's asking for a declaration of war. But Truman deliberately didn't ask Congress for a declaration of war. He could have gotten one, but he didn't do it because he was following, he said the basis for sending U.S. forces into action was that there was a resolution by the United Nations, and he thought that was sufficient. So this really got the isolationists upset because they said he's surrendering American sovereignty to a world government. They were very against that. But most leftists at the time, you might think, well, the leftists would be against the Korean War. The communists were against it. But most people on the left and some conservatives supported the war as a necessary struggle against the communist attempt at world conquest. So we have this split here between the old right, who continues to say America shouldn't get involved in interventionist foreign policy, and the new people say we need to have this struggle against communism. Now, the shift in the right in interventionist direction was led by William Buckley, who founded the magazine National Review in 1955, and what Buckley tried to do was to get rid of people like John T. Flynn on the right, who supported the old isolationist policy. Flynn said in an article defending isolationism, and Buckley wouldn't take it. I think it's significant that Buckley had worked for the CIA, and there various rumors, such as one I've heard from Henry Regnery, also said it was a famous conservative publisher, that the CIA funded National Review. And we do know the CIA funded a number of anti-communist pro-Cold War journals and organizations like the British intellectual magazine Encounter and the Congress on Cultural Freedom. So it's certainly in line with CIA policy at the time. They would support ventures that would be in favor of the foreign policy they wanted. Now, you might think, well, of course, since it's an interventionist magazine, Rothbard wouldn't want to have anything to do with it, but he did it for a while. He wrote on economics for them because the National Review claimed to combine support for the free market. They were very enthusiastic about Henry Hazlitt and Ludwig von Mises. So they said, well, we can support the free market, but we also favor this anti-communist foreign policy. Remember, at that time, libertarianism was considered part of the American conservative movement, so it wouldn't be at all unusual that Rothbard would be writing for National Review. But he split with Buckley over foreign policy, as you might expect. The occasion for the split was in 1959 that Nikita Khrushchev, who was the sort of the Russian leader, was the General Secretary of the Communist Party, visited the U.S. in 1959. And Rothbard was in favor of the visit because he thought that would be a step toward world peace. But Buckley said Khrushchev is really a criminal. He'd been in Ukrainian, helped purge the Ukraine in the 1930s, so it would be indecent to shake hands with him. And then I think Rothbard said, well, what about shaking hands with some of the American leaders? And they didn't get along after that, as you can imagine. Now, Leslie said, did Khrushchev really bang his shoe on the podium? Yes, he did. I'll tell you one rather funny story about that. See, when Khrushchev banged his shoe on the podium, it was in the General Assembly of the United Nations, and the one presiding was the Irish representative, Sir Frederick Boland. So I once asked my great teacher, Walter Starkey, whether he knew Boland, because Dr. Starkey was Irish. So he said, oh, yes, you mean Fornicating Freddy. He was a student of mine, yes. So, but that's just a bit of a digression, never mind that. So not only did the National Review people favor interventionist policy, most of the editorial staff favored preventive nuclear war against Russia. Now, you know, the difference between a preemptive war and a preventive war. Now, supposing somebody you think, say you're a leader of America, and you think, say, Russia's about to attack us, so you say, well, we don't want to let them get in the first blow. We see they're just about to launch their missiles there, so we'll push the button first. That would be called a preemptive war because they're about to attack us, so we let them have it first. But a preventive war is something like, they're not about to attack us now, but we think they might in future. They look pretty dangerous, so we'll launch an attack on them now. You know, why not? Might as well, if a possible threat, why not wipe them out? So the people who favored preventive war included Frank Meyer, who was a friend of Rothbard. He had been a former member of the Communist Party. And oddly, even though he was a former communist, aside from his foreign policy view where he favored preventive war, he was the most libertarian of the National Review editors, and he worked for the Volcker Fund as a reviewer also. So Rothbard got along with him, but they differed very strongly on foreign policy. And another one on the magazine who defended preventive war was Willy Schlamm, who was been very influential in setting up National Review, been associate of Henry Luce at Time magazine. So he was a very seasoned journalist, and he gave Buckley a lot of help in setting up National Review, but he was a defender of preventive war. But the most important writer on foreign policy for National Review, and the real control of the magazine, was James Burnham, who had been a follower of Leon Trotsky. Remember, Trotsky had said he favored world revolution, that communism shouldn't just be confined to a single country, but we should try to spread communism around the world. And Burnham favored what he called a famous book called The Managerial Revolution. He thought that the old struggle between capitalism and communism had been replaced through kind of a new system coming about, with where really technical elite would be controlling things. So you'd have kind of a combination of a partnership between government and the business, that it would be run by this managerial elite. It seemed to be akin to fascism, actually. And this is the system he favored. He seems to say, this is what's inevitably coming. And in Burnham's thought, if something is inevitable, you should get on that side. He wouldn't. He was someone who tried to prognosticate which way was history going, and if you wanted to be on the winning side. So George Orwell attacked Burnham. He wrote against Burnham. He said Burnham is a power worshiper. And plausible view that certainly Rothbard held this, that Burnham's thought was a model for 1984, that when Orwell was writing about the attacking the totalitarianism in 1984, one of his targets was James Burnham. So this is the man who was the main person in National Review on foreign policy. One funny story about him that I heard from my late friend George Resch, who knew Buckley and some of these other people, was that, you see, Burnham lived in Connecticut. He'd been a professor at NYU, but he had an estate in Connecticut. So when Buckley wanted to call him to ask him for advice on issues, as soon as he'd call, Burnham would start the clock and see that he'd charge Buckley for the phone calls, depending on on the time he'd spent answering him. Now, Melvin, do you think Burnham's prediction has come mostly true? Well, I mean, it would depend on different. I don't think he was right that there's an old style capitalism has been replaced in the way he thought it was. He was kind of a proponent of this view that it's really not the owners who are the most significant anymore in controlling firms. I don't think that's really correct. So we have then. There's this group at National Review who say, look, the communists are plotting to take over the world. You know, all this talk about a libertarian state, a minimal government or no government is nice, but what are we going to do? There's this group who's plotting to take over the world. Don't we have to counter them in some way? We can't just let them take over. So Rothbard wouldn't accept that. He had several ways of attacking that view. First, he said, because of nuclear weapons, modern war is illegitimate. Remember, in traditional just war theory, is a theory that was developed first by Catholic thinkers like St. Augustine and St. Thomas Aquinas, and it was extended by Vittori and Hugo Grotius and other writers later, said in war you have to have strict limits on what you can do. I mean, there's a question, when can you start a war at all, when can you engage in war? But putting that aside, even if you're in a war on just grounds, you still have to follow certain limitations, like you can never directly intend to attack civilians. And Robert said, well, because of the indiscriminate character of nuclear weapons and the fact that if you had a real full-scale war, nuclear weapons would be almost certain to be used, he thought modern war was illegitimate. So this, he was against it. He said, this is one reason for opposing the National Review people. You know, they're talking about preventive war, but this would be a nuclear war that would wipe out much of life on our planet. So they, and I mean, some of the preventive war people were very willing to accept that. They said, you should say, better dead than red. And they would talk about how wrong it was to value life unduly. I must say, this seems kind of a rather fanatical view, but that was their view of the matter. So Rothbard said, modern war is illegitimate. The U.S. should follow a non-interventionist policy. Now, what about, though, what seems to be the best point, the strongest point of these Cold War advocates? They say, look, you know, you're talking about non-intervention, how good it is to be libertarians, but the communists are just advancing all over the world. They're trying to take over one country after another, trying to conquer us. Don't we have to do something? So Rothbard was a revisionist on the Cold War, not just on World War I and World War II. He said, was a revisionist on the Cold War too. He said, Russia's policy after World War II was largely defensive. That Stalin, remember, Russia had been very weakened by the war with Germany. Remember, Germany invaded Russia June 22nd, 1941, and the Russians had lost about 20 million people during the war. So they were in a very weakened condition. So what they were trying to do was to ensure that the European regimes in the countries surrounding them, like in Czechoslovakia, Poland, and East Germany, would not be hostile to them. So that was why they installed communist regimes there. Now, after World War I, the communists had been more active in trying to spread communism through propaganda means. But in Rothbard's view, Russia's foreign policy after the war was largely defensive. Now, some people objected to what this Rothbard's policy, or the policy of non-intervention. They said, well, suppose we follow a non-interventionist policy, then, and Russia took over these various other countries, couldn't they then subject the U.S. to nuclear blackmail? You know what nuclear blackmail would be? They say, the Russians say to us, well, unless you do such and such what that we want, then we'll start a nuclear attack against you. So what could we do about this if we followed an isolationist policy where we weren't allied with other countries? Don't we have to counter the threat possibility of nuclear blackmail? Don't we have to have a more forward policy? One of the books by one of the interventionists, Robert Strauss, who Payne, I think he co-wrote that with Stefan Pisoni, who was another strong advocate of aggressive foreign policy, called A Forward Strategy for America. So their idea was, well, because of the threat of possibility of nuclear threat, then we have to have we can't just follow a defensive policy as the isolationists, including Rothbard, said. So Rothbard's counter to that was that we should support disarmament agreements. We should just try to agree to the Russians to get rid of nuclear weapons, and we could do that. Would be the advantage of both countries. Then this would counter this threat of nuclear disarmament. Now, someone I see asked, did Rothbard ever write about or mention the Swiss militia? And he, as far as I know, he didn't say anything. I won't want to say anything. He usually has comments on nearly everything. I'm sure he's familiar. I don't recall anything where he mention that specifically, but I may be wrong about it. I have to check. And I mentioned before, I already covered this split with Buckley came when Khrushchev visited America in 1959, and Rothbard favored the visit, and Buckley opposed it. I already mentioned, I forgot I put it on a later slide, but we already covered that. Now, what I've given so far is how Rothbard was allied with this old right group who were against America's entry to World War I, World War II, and he continued to be an isolationist about the Cold War, and he rejected the move of Buckley to move the American right in an interventionist direction. But in this period when he was writing for National Review, eventually being kicked out of National Review, splitting with National Review, he would still consider himself part of the American right. But this change in 1968, remember what this is when the protests against the Vietnam War were going on. I remember that very well when I was in college. We were all trying to make sure we weren't drafted into the Vietnam War. Of course, I was in such bad shape that when I went down to the draft board, they gave me a choice of joining either side. But there was a left-wing magazine called Ramparts, and in 1968, Rothbard wrote an article for them saying he's now shifting his political alliance from the right to the left, and he became acquainted during this shift with a lot of the people on the extreme left, like the certain members of the Black Panther Party, like Eldridge Cleaver. He met all sorts of leftists. And why would he shift to the left? Obviously, he doesn't like their social views very much. He certainly didn't change his support for the free market. Remember, as I mentioned before, for Rothbard, the key issue in political action is always foreign policy. So he said, well, what is the group? Which groups are opposing the Vietnam War? It's the leftist group, so that's why he wanted to ally with them. But he also said it wasn't just a purely tactical shift. He stressed that although he, and this is a point we covered in one of the previous lectures, although he previously allied with the right, people would consider him a right-winger conservative, he rejected altogether the standard conservative trope where the French Revolution is the source of all or most modern evils. Rothbard was in favor of the French Revolution, thought there was a struggle against the old regime, which is liberty versus authority. There's an old hierarchical order which had been, and now people were struggling to establish a more classical liberal system that was opposing monarchy and aristocracy. So he rejected the conservative reaction to the French Revolution, which is the most famous book of that, of course, is Edmund Burke's Reflections on the Revolution in France. So Rothbard was against that. So here he's saying he's now aligning with the left, and he said, well, look, I've never really been a conventional conservative. I don't accept this division between this reactionary view that the French Revolution was a big mistake. So I would say he had allied with the left. Now, as the 1970s, well, I should say, just kind of as one good gossip item here as a matter, when he was allied with the left, one of the people who was very much with him in this left move was Leonard Liggio. You know, this became somewhat ironical later because Leonard Liggio became associated with all sorts of conservative organizations like the Philadelphia Society. He was the head of a Mont Pelerin Society. He was a very big figure among kind of business and conservative group, but he they supported the, I mean, he was alive. Leonard was sort of the most extreme of the leftists at one time, one of the most extreme of the leftists in Rothbard's circle. And see, he later, in his later years, Rothbard and Leonard didn't get along so well. And we used to, Murray and I used to make jokes. Well, we could have a pamphlet called Leonard's Red Record that might embarrass him. So after the, as I say, he was alive to the left in the late 1960s, but as the 70s progressed, he tended to emphasize the Libertarian Party more and more. And here his principal ally was Bill Evers, who had been a student at Stanford. And so Rothbard became very active in the Libertarian Party, say in he was very interested in which people would be nominated. I remember in I think in the 1976 convention, there was a conflict between Rothbard and Robert Nozick about which person to support for vice president. And as a result of that fight, Nozick dropped his active participation in the Libertarian Party. So Rothbard was very interested in using the Libertarian Party to advance his political goals. But toward the end of the 1980s, he became more and more skeptical of the Libertarian Party, and a lot of the people he supported tended to be didn't win. He would lose various faction fights. So Rothbard, although he had allied with the left, he was very culturally conservative. He wasn't someone who would be interested in these non-conventional or non-bourgeois lifestyles. And he found a lot of the younger libertarians personally distasteful to him, and he would call them space cadets and modals, and he just didn't want to be associated with them. And so in his last year, say from beginning around 1989 to his death in 1995, his inherent cultural conservatism reasserted itself. And again, he's still interested in this key question, is what groups are against an interventionist war-like policy. So he allied now with a group of traditionalist conservatives who rejected the policy of the neoconservatives. The neocons were ones who favored very active intervention. In some cases, the neocons have been former Trotskyites. Just like Trotsky wanted to spread world revolution, they said, well, we have to establish democracies all over, like in Iraq or Afghanistan. So we have to, they played a big role in the Gulf War in 1990 and later after Rothbard's death in the invasion of Iraq. So among the traditionalist conservatives, they were centered around a magazine called Chronicles, which is still around. They included Tom Fleming, who was a Southerner and wrote on interested in application of Darwinism to politics, and Sam Francis, who had been a follower of Burnham, but he had more traditionalist values also. So, as always, foreign policy was primary for Rothbard. And another streak in Rothbard was that Rothbard was sympathetic to populist movements, groups that said, look, these elite thinkers or elite Eastern elites want to control the American people, but really we've got to get rid of them and support the grassroots movement. And in line with this, Rothbard supported Pat Buchanan, although he was Buchanan liked Rothbard personally, although Rothbard was rather leery of Buchanan's economic nationalism, Buchanan's strong advocate of protective tariffs, of course, Rothbard's against that. So in his last years, Rothbard had moved back. he started off part of the right, then he moves to the left in this Ramparts Article 68, and then he's moving more in a right-wing direction. But always the key issue is what will best promote the interests in peace. Okay, so I think we'll stop here. I have a question. I see a couple of questions I missed. Now, Kevin said, with Hopper, we come full circle. Generally, did Hopper influence Murray on anything, obviously, during Murray's lifetime? Well, I think it was the main influence possibly was on Hopper's argument for rights that Rothbard was very interested in one time. I think I may be mistaken about this, but Hans hasn't concentrated all that much on foreign policy in his view. So he didn't have, I don't think he had much direct impact on Rothbard on foreign policy. He tended to go along with what Murray's views, but I don't think he had the same interest in current politics as Rothbard did. Now, Malcolm has an interesting question, why did Rothbard's inherent conservatism reassert itself? Why the hippie movement dead? Besides the joke, did Rothbard see any possible conflicts between with a cultural conservative view and libertarian? Well, I think of course, the hippies weren't as prominent as they'd been in the past, but Rothbard found a lot that he disliked in the Libertarian Party, and that was what repelled him. And he wouldn't at all see being a conflict between being cultural conservative and libertarians as long as you don't attempt to impose culturally conservative values that don't violate libertarian rights on other people by force. Now, Kevin said, and my question about Hoppe came up regarding the French Revolution and the Ancien Regime. I see. Well, I don't think Rothbard ever accepted Hans. You know, Hans is very pro-monarchist. And I don't think Rothbard ever accepted that view. I think, remember, Hans criticizes Rothbard for being a little too sympathetic to democracy. Now, Neil said, did Rothbard comment on the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan, whether that undercut his view of non-expansionist nature of USSR? I think he said certain, I think he viewed that, again, as not very aggressive either, that the communists were simply reacting to various factional groups within Afghanistan. So he didn't think the U.S. should get involved in aiding the anti-Soviet factions in Afghanistan. I have to check exactly what he said, and I don't think he commented in detail on Soviet policy there. Malik says, would elements on the left would consider MR libertarian, he wouldn't consider anarcho-communist liberals. Well, I mean, someone asked about Murray Bookchin, and I think some of the left-wing anarchists didn't consider Rothbard an anarchist. They said, oh, well, if you're a capitalist, you're not a real anarchist, and he didn't like them very much either. He thought if you don't recognize private property, then that would not be consistent with being opposed to government, because people would have individual rights to property that you'd be interfering with. Now, Mao said, when did the libertarian movement evolve the left? This would be principally, I mean, as far as Rothbard's concerned, in this period, from the opposition to the Vietnam War in 68. Now, there are people today who are so-called left libertarians who regard themselves as basically on the left. And I mean, unless he said, didn't Rothbard used to visit Ron Paul in Texas? I think Rand Paul said something about being able to drive Rothbard. Oh, yes. Rothbard had been a very strong supporter of Ron Paul, and he supported him for president. They were very close personally. They thought very highly of each other. They were very, very close. They were both friendly with Lou Rockwell. Now, Christian wants to know about comments on Patrice Lumumba in opposition to the World Bank, IMF. Well, I have to check that. I think the dominant view on the American right at the time was support for independence for Katanga, you know, under Moise Tshombe. But I have to check what Rothbard's view of that. I would doubt he'd be very sympathetic to Patrice Lumumba, although he would certainly be against the World Bank. Malcolm says there was reaction at the left forum on they didn't consider anarcho-capitalism as anarchism. That's very interesting. Now, would you prefer to read Rothbard's eulogy of Buckley instead of the reverse? What might Rothbard have said? Well, I mean, certainly because that would mean Rothbard still around rather than Buckley. I think Rothbard, based on what he said about Buckley, would simply have said Buckley was one of those responsible for moving the American right into an interventionist direction. He would probably have considered him a CIA agent. He wouldn't have thought very highly of him. They'd been friends at one time. You know, when Buckley wrote Up From Liberalism, he'd hired Rothbard to do a study of university economics textbooks, I think, also in God and Man at Yale. I think he used Rothbard to do research. They got along personally for a while, but they clashed very much on foreign policy. Now, Malcolm says, what would Rothbard have said about going to war with Germany in World War II if it was known they were worse on atomic weapons, which they were? Japan had dirty bomb planes via submarine en route to San Francisco at the time Japanese surrendered. I doubt that Rothbard would have considered atomic weapons, at least as they were developed then, that decisive. I mean, I don't think that would have changed his mind very much. You know, it was only lasers where you had massive numbers of them. He thought they were very dangerous, but I don't think he would have considered that such a decisive factor. It wouldn't have changed his view. He would probably say that's all the more reason to avoid going to war with them, you know, if they could do severe damage to us through atomic bombs. Now, Neil says, did Rothbard ever comment on Holocaust revision? I don't agree with this, of course. I gather certain confessions were made under torture and life. Well, that's an issue. I mean, I think he was aware there was such a view, but he never really got into that. You know, I mean, it wasn't something he supported. I mean, I don't think he would have gone along with it. I mean, there are certainly people who held that view, but he wasn't. He never wrote about that. Bob said you mentioned Barbara Tuchman Cain comment on the Zimmerman Telegram book. Well, remember, the Zimmerman Telegram, that was used very much to whip up war fever in the U.S. There certainly was a Zimmerman Telegram, but I don't really know whether there are any inaccuracies in the book, or I couldn't really say much about it other than I know it exists, but I can't really say much about it. Now, Leslie said, did Rothbard know James J. Martin? Oh, yes, they knew each other quite well. Yes, I remember I saw them both at a conference in Eugene, Oregon in June 1979. Yes, they certainly knew each other. Now, I think Rothbard did think that, you know, Jim Martin has a two-volume book called American Liberalism and World Politics, and I thought Rothbard generally liked Martin's work, but he thought that book was just wasn't analytical enough, so he was a bit critical because all he did was go through issues. Martin did was go through issues of the Nation, New Republic, and summarize practically every article in all of them. So I think Rothbard thought that was a bit too tedious. Malcolm says it seems like anarcho-communists are either afraid or not interested. Anarcho-capitalists these days see Graeber refusing to debate Molyneux. Well, I hadn't known about that, the debate between those two would certainly be interesting, although, as you may know, I've had some problems with the Molyneux. And now for the Rev. General William Mitchell, when he was a captain in 1920, and while visiting Hawaii, Japan, he wrote a report predicting 20 years Japan would attack Hawaii on Sunday at 8 a.m. due to oil. I was in the AF then arguing in a paper. Yes, I've heard accounts of that. I haven't studied that in detail, but I've heard accounts of various people who thought it could be, Pearl Harbor was a likely place of attack for the Japanese because it was located very far from the American mainland. I said, my autographed copy of for New Liberty doesn't contain the word super patriot, although early one did. The Rothbard slightly softened some of his views on Ayn Rand in later years. I'm not familiar with that. I mean, I don't say he didn't, but I wasn't familiar with any changes there. But I mean, I'd have to check into that. I don't really know. Kevin says, do you have a view regarding Dr. Paul's recent action obtaining ronpaul.com? Are there IP issues? As a give, we all love RP. Hope this question is appropriate. Well, it's a bit, what I'd say there, I mean, I think this will get me into trouble, but I think certain people, you know, I don't accept patents. I agree with Rothbard in 1990 statement, Rothbard was against patents. But I think people have stressed this anti-IP stuff far more than they should, as if, oh, if we could only get rid of copyrights, there'd be some tremendous growth in world information. This would be absolutely wonderful. I really don't see any basis for that. I mean, it's just something people say. And I will say, you know, people have sometimes referred to, there's an article by Stefan Kinsella, you may know, which I think is a very interesting legal analysis of IP, but some people have referred to a so-called Kinsella revolution. As far as I can see, the article just summarizes some standard IP arguments. I don't think there's any IP revolution there at all. But to answer your question, I mean, I wouldn't see anything to criticize in what Ron Paul is doing. I mean, if you have a certain system in operation, you have to work within that system to prevent other people from doing what you think is inappropriate. I mean, I think there's a tendency sometimes among libertarians to think, oh, well, we have to support any sort of ridiculous consequence because it seems to follow from certain libertarian principles, as if somebody doesn't have a right to prevent others from using his own name because he said, oh, well, somebody's bought the domain name, it's his private property, as if you could just take over somebody's name. I mean, that seems completely ridiculous to me. But again, this is not an issue I've studied in any detail. Let me see. Now, here's one. Taking into consideration Rothbard's own interests of working, talk with those on the left, don't think we can be doing a better job doing the same on some issues. Well, I mean, I think that's a possibility. I mean, it would depend on the issue, I suppose. Now, Craig says, how regularly did Rothbard keep up his analysis of congressional election? A lot of things he wrote in the 1940s, 50s, still pretty interesting. Oh, yes, yeah, well, he followed all the elections. He would always, you can ask him anything about it, the major congressional districts, he'd know them. I mean, he kept up down to as long as he lived. Now did Rothbard or anyone else write about how philanthropy distorts the market and is used to concentrate power? I don't think he wrote on that specifically. No, I mean, there are various studies of foundations. Like, I think B. Carol Reese did a study of foundations, or the Reese, you know, Renee Wormser, Foundations of Power and Influence. Wormser was accounts for the Reese Committee, R-E-E-C-E. It was a congressional committee that was investigating foundations. That would be a good place to look for that. Renee Wormser, W-O-R-M-S-E-R. Especially, yes, he deals with tax exempt states. Yes. I think the, as far as copyright time, I think the treatment, if you look in Man, Economy, and State, Rothbard has very good on, of course, he's against patents. I mean, he thinks that copyright protection can be secured by contracts in certain ways, at least certain parts of copyright can be. And I think he has a very good discussion. But as I say, you know, I'm certainly not in favor of coming out on the pro-IP side, but I think there's been much too much fuss made on this issue that there are some libertarians who are actually saying, well, this is the central issue of our time, is opposition to IP, and that would certainly be never anything that Rothbard suggested. Leslie said, when did Rothbard become interested in German Baroque Church? Well, he'd been interested in art history quite a bit. He knew Steinberg before. He's a great, he was in a youth group. He knew Leo Steinberg, became one of the great art historians who wrote on the Renaissance art. So, I mean, his interest in art went back a long way. And Mal says, on IP, I think Stefan Kinsella's book covers it as well. Oh, yeah, yes, I mean, he's certainly a very good legal analysis of IP, but as I say, I don't accept the view that there's some people who push there's some sort of Kinsella revolution on this topic, that he was simply summarizing earlier IP arguments. Now, Craig says, Mises seems to be anti-tariff, anti-patent, but not anti-copy. Did Rothbard ever seriously discuss these issues with Mises? I don't think so. I'm not aware of that. And again, one thing you remember when we're studying people in the past, we always have to be careful about importing present concerns into what they were doing. So as I say, the view that some libertarians seem to have now that IP is this really absolutely central issue, kind of key issue in our time, is one that would have been very alien, I think, both to Mises and Rothbard. They were against patents, but I don't think they thought that was one of the major things we really have to concentrate on. So I won't let you be wigged. Not if I can help it. I mean, that wouldn't be a very progressive thing to do. Did Rothbard, Neil wants to know, did Rothbard comment on Eric Vogelin? Yes, if you look in that collection I have edited, Strictly Confidential, it has his memos on, he attended a panel on Eric Vogelin. I remember he said to me he thought that, he once asked me, did I think that there was anything, he wanted to know what Vogelin had meant, you know, use the phrase leap in being in order in history, and he found him hard to understand. He thought he was somewhat of a, kind of a bit of a mystic. Of course, Vogelin was in Mises' seminar, and I think Mises liked him quite a bit, although he was not a libertarian by any means. Now, Christians are interested in books, recommend and related to Rothbard. Well, that would depend on the subject. Now, Mal says, if there are going to be any type of IP protection, copyright to pick one, how could that be done without a state? Well, I mean, I suppose one way to have, you might have a contract say that I won't sell you my book unless you agree not to reproduce it. Now, you might look, there's a philosopher I know, Terrence Tomko, T-O-M-K-O-W. If you go to his site, Tomko, T-O-M-K-O-W.com, I think he's in favor of certain kinds of IP, and he sketches how it might, how you might, people might agree on that without bringing in the state. So he might, I'm not defending that view. I'm not in favor of patents, but if you were, that could be one way you might look at what he had to say. But I say the main lesson, the main thing I want to say about IP, you know, is that don't exaggerate the importance of this issue, as Calleran said, not too much enthusiasm. That was his motto. So I think people have kind of, many people these days have gotten kind of really tremendously excited about this issue, and it's, to me, it isn't that big a deal. Maybe I'm wrong about it. I mean, I think in certain areas it could be important, such as in drug regulation. I mean, I think it's tremendously exaggerated. It's saying, oh, if only we got rid of copyrights, then we'd inaugurate some new order. Okay, now Leslie says, with Israel Kurzner's NYU seminar, how did he and Rothbard get along? Yes, Kurzner and Rothbard were both in the seminar for many years. As far as I know, the two of them got along personally quite well. They weren't close friends, but they certainly knew each other, and they weren't, they would be basically compatible in economics. Kurzner didn't really comment on political questions that much, so I don't think that he wouldn't really clash with Rothbard. I think he just stuck to his economic theory. Now, Andrea said, did Rothbard have any major minor influence on anyone in practical in the left when he was associated with it? Well, I think people who were, you know, like Carl Oglesby was one who had been in the, at one time Ronald Radosh, who then later became a neoconservative. I think there were a few leftists he did influence. Now, Craig says, did Rothbard think that pre-World I Soviet Union was expansionist? The next three Baltic states occupied Eastern Poland, fought wars with Finland. Well, Rothbard's view there, surprisingly, was that he was fairly pro-Soviet then, too. I think he thought that, I think he reviewed a book on the war with Finland where he suggested that the Finnish policy under Marshal Mannerheim was pretty aggressive and they could have had a more peaceful view. That led him actually, you know, I'll tell you a funny story there. There was a very, very unusual revisionist historian I used to know, David Hogan, the most unusual person I ever met. So Hogan once looked at Rothbard's review of A.J.P. Taylor's book, Origins of the Second World War. And in the review, Rothbard agreed with Taylor, but Rothbard said Hitler got his well-deserved comeuppance when he invaded Russia. And Hogan commented, you know, Hogan was very pro, he was pro-Hitler, very unusual view, but he was. So he said that this is not what Booth Tarkington meant by the phrase well-deserved comeuppance. Now, Malcolm said, has anyone ever written about how Mises seminar and other seminars were conducted? What were they like? That would be helpful. Well, I think there is some things, I think Bettina Graves has written on this, others, Rothbard maybe a little, but generally it would be a very long talk by Mises, and then he would take questions. Sometimes there'd be student papers, or there'd be debates between students that Mises would have assigned people topics and they'd give reports, but a lot of it was simply Mises lecturing. Now, Bob Wenzel says, were there any relation between Rothbard and Hayek? Well, they certainly knew each other. I don't think they were close personal friends, but Hayek thought highly of Rothbard's America's Great Depression and also his work on the Spanish scholastics. Craig had left it. Nicholas von Hoffman said Rothbard influenced on it. Oh yes, I remember Hoffman was very sympathetic to, like, Inquiry magazine when Rothbard was associated with the Cato Institute. I think Hoffman spoke at least one of the Cato conferences. Now, Malcolm, Rothbard's wife knows both about economics and says, and did she ever write on the subject Rothbard wrote on? Oh, yes, Jolie Rothbard was extremely knowledgeable. She was a very, very intelligent person. I don't think she published anything. She wrote essays. I think she wrote some essays. I remember she gave at the Mises University on the Lincoln's economic policies during the Civil War. That was one thing she wrote about. I mean, she was very up on all of Rothbard's stuff. Yes, certainly. Craig said, did he ever have any second thoughts about the parallel lines? Well, I think he thought that Fleming was rather hard to work with. I mean, he didn't abandon the alliance. The alliance kind of collapsed after Rothbard died, but I think he got along with certain people better than others in it. And I think he was disappointed that they didn't come around to a free market point of view. Now, Malcolm said, what's going to be my next class here? Well, they haven't told me that yet. I'll find out. I'm usually the last one to know this. Malcolm says, at the end of his life, would he describe himself as a paleo-libertarian? My guess is he probably would have. I mean, I think he would just say he was a libertarian. I think he would have probably done that, although maybe he'd been a little bit not as certain as in the previous couple of years, but I think he still would. Well, I guess we're about out of time now, so I want to thank all of you for coming to my class, and very kind of you, I have one more quiz for you, but thanks so much for coming to my class, and very kind of you if you like my class. I appreciate that, and I hope we'll be seeing you again in future classes and at some of the conferences at the Mises Institute. Thanks again, everybody.